I wouldn't be surprised if the average college lifespan is no longer 4 years. I think it might be shortening. So I think colleges are realizing that if you want to really attract and retain students, you have to provide them with great content. And so I think they're realizing now that, you know, this investment in the content is worthwhile.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to Digital to Learn. I'm Tiffany Snyder, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Glad to be here.
And we are excited to bring you part two of our episodes with Katie Egan of CourseArc. Hi, Katie.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me.
If I'm one of your clients and our organization is using your resources, how do we import those things that we've created into our learning management system or into our courses?
So we use a technology called LTI. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with it. It's I think it's called Learning Tools Interoperability. I'm not sure if I have that acronym right. But it's a standard, you know, way back before there was the cloud, people would package their content. You know, they would zip it up and they would use a standard called SCORM. And they would, that you would have to literally, you know, package your content. It would have to have the software inside of it to run it. And then you'd put in your LMS. And then if you needed to make a change, you would have to go back and do it all again. So when LTI came along, it's just, it's a standard connection.
Okay.
So literally all you need to do is put a link into your LMS, and we can build really tight integrations where as teacher can just search and pull something in. So it's just a dynamic link, and then the student never leaves their LMS. The content is embedded in the LMS. So that's the other thing, is they don't, you know, they don't need to sign in or go somewhere else.
That's awesome.
So how did you learn all the tech stuff?
So I didn't learn all of it. My background, I'm an instructional designer. My business partner is really the techie. And so we did early on, we had been doing online course development and lived through Flash, the death of Flash, and learned some really, really hard lessons. And so we did a lot of research before. I mean, part of it is we were blessed, you know, it's a newer technology. We started building this in 2015. So, you know, we didn't have to go back and try to fix something that was outdated, but we did a lot of research and we were like, okay, we can support SCORM, a standard that came out in 2000 and just seems completely outdated, or we can embrace the cloud and just the whole concept of a dynamic link, live updates, the, you know, ability to easily pass stuff to the grade book. So we obviously went with LTI.
Very good.
Yeah, awesome. If you could, can you provide 2 to 3 examples of the impact that you've seen CourseArc have on the education sector?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I would say, you know, the one of the things that we've seen, I'll start with existing clients. So clients that were using CourseArc before COVID, they just had a huge increase in the number of students and courses that they needed to support. So we did have, we have a couple different groups of clients that are in partnerships. And they formed, you know, they quickly kind of formed these, I'd say, alliances where they are sharing content. So we did build a sharing tool for them to be able to do that. So they really, they wanted to own their own content. They didn't want to have to invest in expensive publishing content. So that they were doing really the divide and conquer model. Like, we're not going to be able to create all this content, so we're going to, you know, build teams and get experts and do that. So that was a big thing. The other thing is we have seen, I'm sure you guys have as well, just a huge increase in the need for professional development and professional services. So I would say most of the clients that we have brought on since April have wanted us to to do professional development with them, to work with teams of faculty to build a model lesson, which I actually love that, you know, just that model, that then they can use as an exemplar to everyone else that follows and is building. So I would say that's the other thing. And then I also, just as I alluded to earlier, I think, you know, faculty members are feeling, they're feeling alone, they're feeling uncomfortable. They've been teaching for 20 years and they're experts and they have it down. They know, they knew everything they were going to do, you know, from September to June. They have all of their weeklies and now everything's been thrown out the window. And a lot of times also the, what they implemented in the spring, you know, during this triage mode was a disaster. So, you know, a lot of times plans have been put in place and then they've been thrown out the window. And we, I mean, we have also been contacted in the past couple of weeks, and we've seen this in the news by some colleges that were hoping to be in person this fall, and it's not working out.
I wonder if those disruptions, as painful as they are, will also maybe pay some long-term benefits to the ways that colleges and universities provide education.
Oh, I definitely think so. I do think so. I mean, because I think what this has really exposed is, you know, the need to just to prepare for the future. And I mean, the other thing is they're just there. I feel like even before COVID, there were huge shifts, you know, so, so we're seeing a lot of, at least from my vantage point, a lot of students are not necessarily going directly to a four-year university. They're taking community colleges classes in high school. They are maybe taking them their freshman year and then they're transferring in. Another big trend that we're seeing is if they are, you know, they're taking online classes during the summer, you know, so I don't know if there's research on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if the average college lifespan is no longer 4 years. I think it might be shortening. So I think colleges are realizing that if you want to really attract and retain students, you have to provide them with great content. And so I think they're realizing now that, you know, this investment in the content is worthwhile. I also know that there is a push to build your content yourself. There's starting to be a pretty strong movement that you can't just buy your way out of this. You might find that there may be some off-the-shelf content that you have to purchase because of timing, or you really don't have the expertise in your organization to offer that. But for the most part, I mean, I think they're seeing that there's a benefit. If you do invest and you own the content and it's done by your own team, people within your organization, students are going to respond to that.
Absolutely.
They don't like it when their teacher is teaching them something that the teacher didn't create.
Yeah.
And oftentimes teachers are complaining about it, you know? Yeah. So, and that's actually not just happening at higher ed. I'm sure you guys can guess. I mean, that's running the gamut.
Yeah.
One of my greatest pet peeves during the COVID era has been politicians or newscasters who will make the statement, online education is bad, classroom education is good, as if they can't remember back to that professor they had who lectured from the beginning to the end incessantly. Because classroom education can really be bad. It could also be very good. Same is true of online education, I think.
I totally agree. You're on the mark, It's not all or nothing. And in many cases, the online instruction, depending on the, you know, the scenario, kids can actually get more, sometimes more one-on-one with that and more feedback from the teacher if it really is set up properly than being in the classroom, you know, in the back with 30 kids. So it's harder, you know, again, if you're doing a really good job and it's set up well, it's hard for the teacher to miss some of these students when they're online. And I also think that just if you're using the right technology and the right tools, it also becomes apparent, you know, versus, you know, in the classroom, if you have 150 students in the day, or if you're, you know, a college professor and you're, you know, teaching three sections and you don't grade something for a month, you might not know that someone's failing, or they might not know that's that true. They're not performing if they don't get timely feedback. So I think that there can be some benefits.
My greatest hope is that education becomes more hybridized, if that's a word. So we don't really, there's some great things we can do in the classroom. There's some great things we can do online. We're going to mix those together, and we're not going to rely on either of them totally.
Yeah,
I agree. Just personally, my goal from all of this is for there to be an end to snow days.
Yes.
So I would love for there just to be, you know, whenever there's a big storm, you know, your state might handle it differently, but in Maryland, you know, half an inch, an inch, everything shuts down. It's insane. So it would be nice just to be like, there's a switch. It's a virtual day. So no one has to do. So that's my hope. That's what I'm pushing for.
So we may be 5 years down the road until we really realize the benefits of what has happened during this span of time. As people begin to look back and go, hey, we did it this way. Let's try something different. Mm-hmm. I think those benefits will come long term, hopefully.
Yeah, I think so too. I do think one thing that I've seen more, just to add, I'm not sure if I said it earlier or not, but I have seen a lot more collaboration, which I think is great. Which is ironic, but you know, a lot of times even if you're on a college campus, you're not necessarily collaborating, you know, with your fellow faculty members or lecturers. So I think that hopefully that's something that continues. I think that's great.
We've noticed that I've talked to more people, and people I normally don't even talk to or wouldn't connect with during this period of time than I ever would if I were going into the office every day. And secondly, our meetings become more intentional.
Yeah.
So even though we schedule an hour, we're done in 20 minutes. It's like, okay, let's go. It's I think it's going to be a culture changer over time.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and also just, you know, and not just that, but just there are a lot of things where it's like, oh, wait, we don't need to meet in person for that, you know? So I work out with a personal trainer once a week. And when COVID happened, I just thought, what are we going to do? You know, and then I was like, wait a second, like, let's do this over Zoom. And, you know, there's three of us. And I thought, this is going to be so awkward. It's not going to work. And it was fine. I mean, I enjoy in-person better, but it's, you know, it's an option for when you have to do that. So, so I agree. I think there's, you know, people are rethinking meetings and, you know, a lot of different things.
I do have to share just a funny thing. So I do think Zoom creates opportunities where there aren't otherwise, but a colleague of ours helps with the podcast, Brady Boswell, just recently shared a video with us where it also showed that we've shifted so much to Zoom that sometimes we overuse it. So what could easily be achieved in a phone call, we say, hey, do you want to hop on Zoom? And it kind of mocks, I guess, if you will, the need to see each other to ask a simple question. And it just so happened the day he sent that, I asked Brad that very thing. Hey, can we meet? Can you hop on Zoom? When a phone call really could have settled my question or an email.
It's so funny.
It is funny how, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
So should we be planning for the time when Zoom goes down? What are we gonna do then?
Yeah.
Well, that was Monday, right?
That's true.
It went down on Monday. I just know that because we had several trainings planned in the morning and it was like, oh boy. That's where you have your backup plan though. You gotta have a backup plan.
Always, always. Still. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, in our doing homework on you and CourseArc, we learned that you and—
Isn't that called stalking?
No, I changed the word to homework.
It sounds much more scholarly
for this podcast.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, we had some complaints filed to the podcast for using the word stalking. So in our homework, you and your business partner, we found, are also involved in some nonprofit work. Can you tell us more about your work with How Girls Code?
Sure. So Bethany and I, when, you know, we're running a software company, we learned early on that we were somewhat of an anomaly. Okay, I got it. Lordy. So people often would just kind of, you know, do a double take when they would say, what do you do? And I would say, you know, I run a software company. So we started being asked to speak at events to encourage young girls to pursue computer science. So we started researching it, like what's going on? And, we learned that the statistics were pretty awful. So in the 80s, close to 40% of all of the computer science graduates were women. And in 2004, which is right around the time that we started this organization, or we started, getting asked to speak and stuff, that number had dropped to 15%. Wow. And then the other really horrible statistic that not a lot of people talk about is only 1 in 3 women that graduate, in computer science engineering stay in the field.
Wow.
So 2 out of 3 drop out, and, they started to do surveys and ask them. And the number one reason is the climate. So, we did a lot of research, and I at the time had 2 young daughters that were in elementary school, and we found most of where we were being asked to speak were, high school events and middle school. And even if you look at, I know that most people know about Girls Who Code, which is a national program. I just felt like that's too late. Like that intervention is not going to work. You need to get the girls early. So we decided that we were going to start a program to encourage girls to code in elementary school.
Wow.
So we started at my daughter's elementary school, 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade girls. And there's an organization called code.org that has just amazing online instruction. So we used that and, created some materials ourselves. And so we started that year with, I think there were 20 girls, and now we're in 20 different schools, and I'm in Howard Wow. County, Maryland. And we also do a camp, other than this year, we couldn't do it, but we also do a camp every year. It's called Mind, Body, and Coding. So it's robotics, coding, and yoga. And we do that at UMBC.
Nice.
So we
goodness.
Do it, just to kind of expose girls to the robotics labs and all these cool, on campus. And we've been pretty successful in challenging the stereotypes. A lot of people think that, the only people that code are young white men that wear a hoodie and work in their basement. And so we've really been able to bring in guest speakers and all different women. I started this when my older daughter was in, 4th or 5th grade, and she's now in 11th grade. And we got the statistics, I want to say it was last year, on the number of girls that took the AP computer science test at her high school. And it was one of the highest in the county. So it was kind of exciting in terms of whereas when we first started that first year, there was one girl in AP computer science that year in the high school level. So it's just fun. It's been great. We just hope, again, it's not for everyone, but we hope that given that technology really is part of so many different facets of our lives, most people would say it's kind of the underpinning of pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. You just think it's important that they consider that as a career path.
Yeah.
One of the best things about doing this podcast has been every guest that we've had has just been able to talk about their passion. And that's obvious from what you've described today, how strongly you feel and how much you love what you're doing. Mm-hmm. What a great blessing that is.
Yeah.
I do. I'm very fortunate. I know there are days like we talked about earlier where you complain and, sometimes you're looking for that off ramp, but no, most days I love it. And I love the before and after. I love working with someone who just has only used PowerPoint before and lectured and watching them transform the content. It's just great. And hearing stories, from teachers that are like, oh my gosh, my students love this. We got an email from a college teacher last week. It's fun. It's a good gig. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being with us today. This has been great fun.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And for all of those millions of listeners we have out there, we'll be back very soon. And thanks for joining us.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are 3 things we ask you to do. 1, come back and join us again. 2, tell your friends about us. And 3, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.